Vaydaber Hashem El Moshe V'El Aharon Lemor Zos Chukas HaTorah Asher Tziva Hashem Lemor Daber El Bnei Yisrael V'yikhu Elecha Fora Aduma Timima Asher Ein Bahmum Asher Lo Allah Aleha O. Hashem spoke to Moshe and to Aaron, saying, "This is the decree of the Torah, which Hashem has commanded, saying, speak to the children of Israel, and they shall take to you a completely red cow, which is without blemish, and upon which a yoke has not come."
Hello, I hope I haven't kept you waiting. Come right over. Ah, you're here. Good. Take the easy chair by the window. Comfortable?
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Chukat. Recording and first broadcast, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the fifth day of Tammuz 5773, corresponding to June 13th. Not the 14th. Okay, got to keep that in mind. I got those confused. Today is the 13th. Tomorrow is the 14th, which is Flag Day in the United States. Not relevant to us here anyway. But today and tomorrow is very special in Jerusalem. It is Formula One comes to Yerushalayim for a formula of peace or something like that. Streets are closed off near the Liberty Bell Park, near the Old City. King David, and they will not be having a race. They postponed that for some other time, but they will be having parades of all kind of fancy cars and antique cars, I think. I don't know. It's been hyped, but all we know is that it's going to cause public transportation problems and driving problems in our part of the city for today and tomorrow. In any event, I just don't know how the quality of this recording is compared to previous weeks. My favorite headset and microphone was giving me a terrible hum, which I tested out and found that it comes off on the recording, comes out on the recording. So I switched to an old headphones where the speakers don't work, but the microphone apparently does, and I don't detect a hum. So I'm going to be using that. Maybe I will raise the gain a little here to get some more volume because the marks are not high as usual on the, whatever you call it, input level. But that's neither here nor there. We'll talk more in a moment. But let's say Tehillim Kuf Lamed Psalm 130. Shir ha-ma'alot mima'amakim kraticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli tihiena aznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Im avonot tishmorya Adonai miya amod ki imacha hasalicha l'ma'an tivarei. Kiviti Adonai kiveta nafshi v'lidvoro hochalti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim l'boker shomerim l'boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai ha chesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifdeh et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanatunim batzara uvashivya ha'omedim bein bayam ubein ובין ביבשה, המקום ירחם עליהם, ויוציאם מצרה לרווחה, ומאפלה לאורה, ומשיבוד לגאולה, השתה בעגלה ובזמן קריב, ונאמר אמן. Chukat is one of those words that when you take it alone without the phrase that it's meant to be in, you have a little bit of an anomaly grammatically. The word is chok or chukah, and the smichut, meaning when you say the law of, the decree of, the word becomes chukat, but it needs a, whatever you call it, an object, I guess. So in the Torah, it's chukat ha-Torah, specifically zot chukat ha-Torah. This is the chukah of the Torah. And it's talking about para aduma. So we'll call it chukat or chukat, which is the wrong accent, but that's the way we say it when we speak English. I had a whole discussion with some people about the English-speaking kindergartens that many of our children and grandchildren go to, and the philosophy or the thought behind it being that Hebrew, the kids will pick up naturally in their environment and in school when they get there, and to give them a good, strong English background, speak English in the house. I'm talking about children and grandchildren of Olim, and even send them to an English-speaking gan. Their Hebrew will be poor at the beginning, but they will more than make up for it, and their English will stay solid. We did that with our three daughters, and we're not at all regretting the results. They are fluent in Hebrew and English. They are natural in Hebrew and English. They are almost unaccented in either language. Even way back, I'll never forget when I went to a parents-teachers meeting, and the teacher obviously picked up from my Hebrew that I was American, and she was shocked. She said, "Your wife is American also?" "Yeah." She said, "Miri speaks so naturally in Hebrew that she didn't detect a usual American accent." In any event, we were speaking about English guns and how there are certain words they really shouldn't bother rendering into English because we don't use the English word even when we're speaking English. Shabbos morning, people go to shul. They don't go to synagogue. That's not part of our vocabulary, even though officially, if we were talking Hebrew, we would say Beit Knesset, and if we were talking Yiddish, I guess we would say shul. But if you're talking English and you come from a certain background, then you say you're going to shul and you're going to daven in shul, not to pray in synagogue. So I believe not to teach a kindergarten age kid, or even earlier, pre-kindergarten, words like synagogue and pray, because it comes out very awkward. At some point or another, they will realize that the word daven is borrowed for our style English, and it's not original English, and you might not find it in an English dictionary, although I suspect that shul you might find, and certainly words like Torah and menorah and many others you find in English dictionaries. I remember Random House being very big on bringing into English words that are used when people speak English, even though they come from Hebrew or Yiddish, mostly Yiddish. So there you can find shlemiel and shlemazel and schlep and all of those kind of words. And anyway, I digress. So if I say chukat, the word when you read it is chukat, and it belongs with chukat ha-Torah, but we still call the sedra chukat. Okay. Now, the introduction of zot chukat ha-Torah. This is the quintessential decree of the Torah. Then proceeds to discuss in detail the Para Aduma, the red heifer, in short, a fully red cow. Red does not mean the color red of a traffic signal to tell you to stop. Color red is more like we would call gingy hair, a red-headed person. That's the red that we're talking about, and we're talking about a cow that is completely covered in that color hair. No white hairs, no black hairs. I'm not so sure about some browns, whether certain shades of brown are borderline red. That would be a halachic discussion by itself for those who need to deal with the validity of a potential para aduma. In any event, a solid gingy, a solid red cow, blemish-free, never worked, and minimum age of 2 years. And that animal is not a sacrifice, but it is used to prepare a very special potion to purify people who have become ritually defiled because of contact with a dead body. I'm trying to keep this short, but I also realize that some of the listeners might need some more of this background. Ritual impurity, or ritual defilement, in Hebrew, tum'ah, tameh, tum'ah, is contracted in different ways, and most forms of defilement are purified after a 1 day or 7 day period by immersion in a ritual bath, a mikveh. One type of tuma, called tumat mate, defilement from contact with a dead body. Contact means touching the body. Contact means even being under the same roof as the body, renders a person tamei. Not only does he have a 7 day period of tumah, and on the 7th day immerses himself in a mikveh, and when the 7th day passes, he becomes tahor, ritually undefiled, pure, and he must have had an application, we'll call it, of the potion prepared from the red heifer, the para aduma, on the 3rd day and on the 7th day of his counting period. Without that application, sprinkling of the potion of the para aduma, the ritual defilement from contact with the dead body does not leave the person. Since we do not have the potion of the para aduma today, then everybody essentially is tamei mate, defiled from contact with a dead body, and remains that way until we will again have a para aduma, which is prepared to make the potion that will alleviate the ritual impurity of that person, those people who have come into contact with a dead body. Now, there is a concept in mitzvot known as chok. A chok is generally considered an enigmatic mitzvah, one that is not necessarily definable as common sense, rational, reasonable, logical. And as I am telling you these details, I am realizing just how enigmatic the para aduma is. First is the general issue of why there is ritual impurity from contact with a dead body. That's a story by itself. Briefly, since the body is the receptacle of the soul during a person's lifetime, and since no person is himself blemish-free, free from sin, and sin can be seen as the body's improper behavior towards its neshama, its soul. So that when the soul leaves the body and all you're left with is the dead body, it imparts, it is ritually defiled, and imparts defilement in the most severe way as a message that the body is the guilty party for sin, and sin is, as I just mentioned, a gross mistreatment of the soul which we are entrusted with. There is a famous analogy, a mushal, a parable to a king whose daughter, the princess, fell in love with a peasant fellow, and he with her, and they wanted to get married. And the king said no, and the daughter begged and pleaded and wouldn't eat and wouldn't talk to her parents, you know, the usual thing from the stories. And finally the father realized that there's no way that he's going to be able to stop his daughter's feelings, and he loves her, so he agrees to the marriage. And he calls the prospective son-in-law into his chamber and up for a private chat, and he says, look, I'm giving permission for this marriage, but I warn you, you better treat my daughter like the princess that she is, and not like a peasant would necessarily treat his own wife. The body is entrusted with a soul. That soul is the princess, so to speak, of God. And that body, entrusted with the soul during a lifetime, is charged with following a life of Torah, of mitzvot, of good behavior, of acts of kindness, because that's how a soul is to be treated. Every sin is not only a sin against God, so to speak, but it is also a mistreatment of the soul. And that is manifest by the status of Avi Avot HaTumah, the most intense form of ritual impurity of a body. And when it imparts that to a person who comes in contact with it, the person has this requirement to undergo not just ritual immersion and not just counting period of 7 days, but the administration of the potion of the Parah Aduma, which gives him further pause for thought. The Parah Aduma, according to the famous Medrash expressed by Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan and quoted by Rashi, is that the mother of the golden calf is called to atone for her son and is burned, slaughtered, blood is sprinkled towards the Temple Mount. This is being done on Har HaZeitim, facing the Temple Mount across the valley, not in the temple area itself, and not in our time yet. And the animal's carcass is burned, together with branches from a cedar, and the hyssop plant, and the thread of shani, crimson thread, together, each one symbolizing different things. The ashes are then mixed with living water, which means water from a live spring, and that potion is used to sprinkle on the person who is tamei, and it purifies him. Does that make sense? Not common sense. It's not reasonable. It's not like you get dirty physically and you wash with soap and water. And yet, there is a concept here which we are commanded to follow, and we are told right up front that this is a chok, and if the nations of the world or your fellow Jews challenge you and say, come on, give me a break, a red cow, doesn't have any black or white hairs, otherwise it doesn't count. You burn it, you put in twigs and plants, and you mix that with water, and hocus pocus, you're now ritually pure when before you weren't. That we answer by holding our head up high and saying, this is what God commanded us. And we will do it because he commanded us. That's the nature of a chok, and this is the epitome of the chukim of the Torah. Zot chukat ha-Torah. Ve'ein laharher acharav, and you don't challenge it. I want to make it clear that I could present the details and full discussion of all of the matters related to Parah Aduma from the text in Chukat, from the Mishnayot in Taharot, and Oholot, and Parah, and the Shulchan Aruch, the Rambam, but I want to focus, because I think it is a more fundamental and practical issue, to focus on the concept of a chok or a chukah. In other words, Judaism consists of many, this is not the only one, of many commands that a person who is trying to be sensible and trying to understand things, and maybe he's doing a little too much thinking, is going to react and say, that doesn't make any sense. That sounds kind of silly to me. And we say, stop. We don't do it because it makes sense. We do it because we're commanded. This does not mean blind adherence. It means a commitment to follow, even until we understand, and even if we never understand. But that's not the same as blind adherence, because we will examine the situation, we will read the literature on the situation, we will discuss it and hear shiurim, and get little insights, and get more and more comfortable with it. And then we will learn from it, and grow with it, and appreciate that there are things in this world which God has given us that are not easily understood, but they still enrich one's life. And I think Parah Aduma fits that bill very significantly. In any event, the Torah started by saying, Zot Chukat HaTorah. Hold that thought. We'll be right back with more Torah Tidbits audio for Parshat Chukat. You are listening to Torah Tidbits audio for Parshat Chukat. And before we get back onto the topic at hand, I'd like to play a clip from an album I bought this morning. Actually, it's a set of four CDs from a group called Lechatchila, mostly music wedding. It was not expensive, and has a lot of tracks, and I like listening to that kind of stuff. And it's made in Israel, and I'm looking at the Hebrew titles of the songs, and Od Yeshama Asher Bara, or Wedding Songs, Rosh Chodesh. And I find one that I read as Kantari. And I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, but I was curious, and I played it. And I smiled, and I went back and I read it again, and it says, country. So, even though I usually don't play this kind of music, and whatever, I don't know if you like country music, this is an instrumental piece, a little less than 2 minutes, and it's country music, but by a Hasidic wedding band. And you either like it or you don't like it, enjoy it or not, take a break. I like it, and I wanted to share it with you. So, from the group Lahakat Lechatchila, the track called Country. I just realized that people who listen to this show because they look for Torah Tidbits audio and they start from the beginning understand why I had that kind of music on there. But on Arutz Sheva, they put this into a live stream. And in Radio Shalom in Montreal, if they still broadcast it, they have it as a live show on the radio. I can imagine somebody looking for, you know, looking at his watch saying, oh, I missed the first, part of the show, but maybe we'll get some of Torah Tibbetts audio, tuning in right at that point in the middle of the country music, and being quite confused and puzzled, and I apologize to those people if there are such people. In any event, I challenge you again, I have not heard from Mark even lately, about the opening music in the second half as well as the first half. So I'm not going to tell you what it is, and instead let's continue. Now, before I get into my new thing this year, I get very excited when I have a new twist on an old thought and or a different way of putting something together. So I'm going to share with you the same thing I did with the lead tidbit in the hard copy of Torah Tidbits. But I imagine I'll be able to express it a little bit fuller than I had room for in print. That's always the benefit of giving it as a shiur, which I did this past Monday, even before Torah Tidbits came out, and I'm going to speak about it here as well. But before that, shatnez. Not a lot of wear garments of wool and linen. Okay, not a lot of wear garments of wool and linen. Can I make a tablecloth of woolen linen, linen tablecloth, and embroidered design with wool thread? Yes, I just can't wear it. What about cotton and wool? No problem, you could mix them, etc., etc. There are elements of the mitzvah of shatnez, the prohibition of shatnez, that defy logic. And yet, as much as we're not allowed to eat pork, we're not allowed to wear garments of woolen linen. And that includes a wool garment that has linen threads that are used to sew on the buttons, or a fabric of linen inserted between the front and back of the jacket in order to stiffen the jacket itself. That's all chutneys and forbidden by Torah law. Interesting that I chose pork and chutneys, because the old-time ads, flyers, posters for the Chutney's Laboratory on Lee Avenue in Brooklyn, which is where it all started, were a guy, had a picture of a guy, a drawing of a guy wearing a jacket, and a little label pointing to it as having woolen linen, and it shows him pushing away a pork roast, and the slogan was Trefo nit und Schatnes ja. Non-kosher food is a no, but wearing chutneys is okay. In other words, the point is it's forbidden. It's another example of a chok, as opposed to don't steal, which is a very reasonable, logical kind of thing, as opposed to honoring your parents, which is a very logical command. Nobody says honoring your parents. What kind of weird thing is that? But taking leather boxes, painting them black, inserting into them four passages of the Torah written on parchment, rolled up and put into the boxes, and tied onto your arm with a leather strap and onto your head with leather straps, that's the mitzvah of tefillin. People have, especially people outside of Judaism, a different kind of way of looking at you. That's kind of weird. What are you doing that for? So generally, as I've already said before, quoting Rashi, the answer, anytime we are challenged, what are we doing that for? It doesn't make any sense. Doesn't have to make sense. God commanded it. I have total confidence and faith and trust that He knows what He's doing, and I do it. And I spend as much energy as I want trying to get more and more into why. And if I can't, then I'm no different from Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, who in his great wisdom said he was able to grasp all of the meaning of the Torah, but Parah Aduma eluded him. Okay, if it eluded him, it could elude us too. Now, follow me please on this. I did a search in the Torah for the phrase Zot Chukat HaTorah. This is the Chukah of the Torah. And of course I found Parah Aduma. I got one other hit. A mitzvah which we find in Parshat Matot. The army of 12,000 has just successfully defended God's honor and the honor of the people in their battle against Midian. And the returning soldiers bring with them spoils of war, which include vessels for food of gold and silver and iron and tin and lead, and Elazar HaKohen is the one who commands them and reviews with them the laws of what to do with them. One of the things they will have to do is immerse them in a mikveh to purify them. That's a spiritual thing. But another thing they will have to do is to purge the metal vessels of the taste of the foods which are not acceptable to us, which they have absorbed by use in the hands of other nations. Hachsharat kelim, kashering of vessels. Hag'alat kelim. Sometimes, depending on how the metal was used, you need serious blow torching. White hot. Other times you need what's called libun kal. Sometimes boiling water will do the trick. Sometimes even immersing in cold water will do the trick, depending upon how the vessel was used in the first place. A barbecue grill has to be scrupulously cleaned and then blowtorched till the grill itself would ignite a piece of straw if you touched it to it. That's how hot you have to make it in order to purge it of its non-kosher absorption. Reasonable? I think so. Common sense? I think so. I don't think anyone would say, God, that's ridiculous. Why would you do that? You would do that because this vessel was used for non-kosher food, and you want to use it. If it were made of wood, you'd have to throw it out. If it were made of clay, you'd have to throw it out. But if it's made of a metal, you can purge the non-kosher from it. Reasonable law. Guess how the Torah introduces it? With the words, Zot Chukat HaTorah. This is the Chukah of the Torah. Wait a minute. You want to make a case for Para Aduma being enigmatic? You got it. I didn't even mention the most enigmatic thing of it. That the potion of the Para Aduma is used to purify the defiled. And it defiles a person who is not Tameh. That's the classic question. What do you have there? Something that's mitaher tameim and mitameh tohorim. Strange. All right, there are ways of working on that also, but that's not the point. Nobody would say, after listening to the instructions of koshering kalim, one of my daughters called me today to tell me that her cleaning lady took a meat spoon to stir her hot coffee and milk. What should she do with it? So I gave her instructions. Clean it well, let it sit for 24 hours, and there's a halachic reason for that as well, and then boil up water and throw the spoon in and leave it there for 30 seconds, take it out, rinse it in cold water, and it's fine. No one would say, wow, that's the weirdest thing I ever heard of. It's not weird. It's not strange. It's not enigmatic. It is very practical. And yet, that's the other place that the Torah introduces a mitzvah with the phrase Zot Chukat HaTorah. What do you do with that? So here's my answer. Not taking away anything from Para Aduma. Totally different way of looking at things now. Zot Chukat HaTorah on a common sense mitzvah? Yes. Because when the nations of the world ask us, when our fellow Jews ask us why we do something, the answer first and foremost is because God commanded it. It doesn't matter on this level that I'm speaking now whether it's an enigmatic mitzvah or a common sense mitzvah. Rambam, when he presents the meaning for shofar on Rosh Hashanah. Why do we blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah? He says, I'm going to give you a whole bunch of reasons, but you should know, first and foremost, we do it because it is a command. Then, when you accept that, or when you hear that, then we could talk about a reminder of Akedat Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac, with the horn of the ram that replaced him on the altar. Then we could talk about the ingathering of the exiles, which is accompanied by the sound of the shofar. Then we could talk about a reminder of revelation at Sinai, which is described as being accompanied by the sound of the shofar. And we could keep going on and on. But none of those is the answer to the question why we do it. When a person is overloaded with packages, there is a mitzvah in the Torah to help that person unload himself. It's in the language of unloading his beast of burden, but the Sefer Achinuch says, how much more so does it go for burdening of a person? So when you see somebody with packages, and you say, can I give you a hand? And they say, here, sure, thank you. Then you are fulfilling a mitzvah. Why did you do it? Why did you say, can I help you? Oh, because it's a nice thing to do. Yes, but there's an answer that goes before that. And you shouldn't be embarrassed about it either. And you shouldn't think that it takes away from the act of kindness that you're doing, and which is probably your motivation. The answer first and foremost is, because God commanded me to do this in the Torah. I know this might sound strange, because we don't think that way. But it's not strange, because Zot Chukat HaTorah. If, as I am claiming, we've got the epitome of enigmatic mitzvah, Para Duma, prefaced with the words Zot Chukat HaTorah, and we have an example, not the most, but an example of an understandable mitzvah that is also prefaced by Zot Chukat HaTorah, then it's not that much of a jump to say Zot Chukat HaTorah refers to the Torah. And when anyone challenges us, when we challenge ourselves, when we think, we are doing it because God commanded it. Yes, you love your parents, and that's why you respect them and honor them. But God commanded that. V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, love your fellow as yourself. That is a command, and that actually in the verse says, Ani Hashem, I am God. That's why I command you to do this. And that should be your main reason for doing it. Everything else is a fringe benefit. A nice fringe benefit. It feels good to do. It feels like it's the right thing to do. That's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. But one should not say, the mitzvot of the Torah are only the ones that I don't understand. The other things are the things that I would come up with on my own. Irrelevant. Zot Chukat HaTorah. I want to change gears now for the few minutes that I have left on the show. Tammuz, the month we have just begun, is usually associated with Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, the 17th of Tammuz, which is one of the fast days in the commemoration of the destruction of the temples. Specifically, we'll talk about it more next week. And Shiva Asar B'Tammuz means the beginning of the three-week period. And that becomes the flavor that we get, the smell of Tammuz. If you count, you'll find that starting from the 17th to the 29th, you've got 13 days. That's less than half the month. And it's unfortunate that the beginning of the month, the first half plus, gets colored when you hear the word Tammuz, you think Shiva Asar B'Tammuz. Because there's an event which we passed already. It was the third day of Tammuz, Sunday, Monday, this past Tuesday. That was the third of Tammuz, which is the date assigned by tradition, identified by tradition, mentioned in the Sefer HaTodah by Eliyahu Kitov, of the miracle that is recorded in the book of Yehoshua, Shemesh beGivon Dom veYoreach beEmek Ayalon, when he commanded that the sun and the moon should stand in its place, which means he should have more daytime in order to finish a battle. And a miracle happened, and we don't know what elements of creation were used to bring that about, but the Navi records it. That, in my way of thinking, always reminds me of Kiddush Levana, when we speak of the sun and the moon doing their bidding, doing their tasks unfailingly with joy, and yet here they were told to stop and they stopped. And now we're talking about miracle versus nature. That's fine. But there are all kind of good things to think about as far as creation, as far as the normal way things go, and the miraculous, and how they blend nicely. And that should also be part of our Tammuz thoughts. That's about it for this show. So I will wish you a Shabbat Shalom, l'hishtameach.